Pardon me, everyone. This is the operator. Just need to inform you that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect your line at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you ever so much, Larry. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is the IRCPD call on the 10th of February, 2014. On the call today, we have Mikey O'Connor, James Waddell, Holly Raich, Barbara Knight, Volker Greiman, Chris Chaplow, Christine Brain, Avery Doria, and Graham Banton. We have an apology from Paul Diaz, and from staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Barry Cobb, and myself, Matthew Peregrine. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you ever so much, and over to you.
Thank you, Natalie and Lori, and welcome everyone to IRTPD, PDP Working Group call for February 10th. And as per our normal order of business, if anyone has any changes to their statements of interest, please indicate so by interrupting me now on the phone or raising your hand in the Adobe chat room. Okay, seeing no takers there, I would ask everyone who has had a chance to review the draft agenda that was circulated on the list and appears in the right-hand column of the Adobe chat room. Does anyone have any comments or additions to that draft agenda? Okay, so we will consider that agenda adopted. So thanks, everyone, for rejoining. And we wanted to note that we are making fairly good progress. The initial report, at least the latest draft, was circulated on the working group. I noticed that there was a fairly healthy conversation on a couple of threads. I would be less than totally honest if I told you that I was following them all, because I was stuck in the Denver airport for seemed like most of last week, but I think it was just like 7 hours. So I was not able to keep up with some of the traffic that was going on there. But I did see the note this morning from Holly and Lars and I believe Mikey that some of those comments were captured in this draft. So Lars, just to confirm that those comments that were circulated last week on the list are reflected in this draft that was sent to the list this morning and appears in the Adobe room?
Yeah, absolutely, James. Sorry, this is Lars. The changes have been made, and also the paragraph that I sent around this morning following Holly's email is also included in recommendation D.
Excellent. Thank you very much for the quick turnaround on that, Lars. For folks who haven't had a chance to see it, this will be a good time to review. So let's then continue, and I think it says page 22, but I thought we were a little further down the road than that. I could be misremembering. Lars, do you have a bookmark or a placeholder or someplace, or did you leave a breadcrumb so we can find our way back?
I think we left off at question E last week, but I think we went as good as through there too.
So E is in Edward?
Yeah, E is in Edward. It's the FOA. I believe it's the FOA. Recommendation is rather short. If we don't want to go back in looking through the changes which I've implemented following the discussions, then there's always Annex C with the use cases, which would follow also from the conversation that was on a different thread mainly last week.
Okay, thank you. That does sound familiar now. So my recommendation is there are no objections. Let's read through E and F fairly quickly because they are as Lars indicated, those were very short. And in fact, we discussed these charter questions very early on in our work. We identified that these were, we call them low-hanging fruit, and we knocked those out, I think, in the first couple of weeks after this working group was standing up. We may have to jog our memories a little bit here and just circle back to, earlier, this last summer or something like that to get us to remember where we were. But it should be just a few minutes here. We'll run through those, and then we can go through Annex C, the use cases, and then we'll circle back and take a look at some of the highlighted red text. And then I think then we're at a position, and certainly open to any course changes here from the group, but I think then we're at a position where we can say, yes, we need to start going through this thing section by section because we're ready to put some final touches on this thing and get it going. So let's start with the charter question E, which is section 5.2.5 at the bottom third of page 33. Charter question, whether existing penalties for policy violations are sufficient or if additional provisions or penalties for specific violations should be added into the policy. Description, blah, blah, blah. And we go down to the working group observations. There was only one part that I wanted to capture here, if I can just editorialize for a moment. I think I want to be sure that we didn't say that it would be unprecedented for an ICANN policy to come with its own set of sanctions, because I think the AGP limits policy would probably be a fairly prominent exception to that statement. So if we make any statements like that, Lars, we should probably indicate that it's unusual or atypical as opposed to unprecedented. And I see a green check mark. So, yeah, just didn't want anyone to kind of hold that up in the meeting and say, aha, I gotcha, here's a policy where you guys are wrong. So then skipping down to 5.2.5.3, preliminary recommendations, the working group concludes that the new penalty structures, which have come into place with the 2009 RAA and the 2013 RAA, are sufficiently nuanced to deal with IRTP violations. Therefore, the working group recommends no additional policy penalty provisions are added to the existing policy. Furthermore, the working group recommends that, as a matter of principle, the GNSO consensus policy should not have individual sanctions. So here I think we should say should avoid rather than should not have, because I think that is contradicting AGP limits. Rather, it is desirable that the overarching RAA and RRA penalty structures is drafted in a way that assures uniformity and consistency of policy violation penalties. So my recommendation here, do we say RRA or do we mean RA, the registry agreement? Or do we mean the registry-registrar agreement? Because that's between two private parties and not us.
Yeah, I think, this is Mikey, I think we mean RRA there.
Okay, awesome. Thanks, Mikey. I thought I was losing it there for a minute. And then I just think that we, instead of saying should not have, I think we should say should avoid or should not typically have or something like that. I think that, yes, okay, green. I saw a hand and then I saw a green check mark. So, Lars, are you good?
Sorry, James. Yeah, all good. I meant to do the check mark at the hand, whatever.
Okay, thanks. Thanks. So we're good there. Any other thoughts from the group on this? Either the recommendation, the language, or the concept. I know it's been a long time since we've looked at this particular issue and some of the things that we came up with. I want to make sure everybody's still on board with all this and nothing's happened in the intervening months to change your mind. So I want to give everybody an opportunity to pull the brakes if they think we're going too fast. I see green check marks from Mikey. I guess it's either really early in the morning or this is just so non-controversial that nobody even wants to... green check mark from Barbara. That carries a lot of weight with me, by the way. And Holly. Okay, well, we'll have another opportunity to look at it certainly before this report goes out, but I feel like this is a well-trod path here. Okay, so then moving to charter question F. As in finished. whether the universal adoption and implementation of EPP Auth Info Code has eliminated the need for FOAs, I think, instead of FOAs. Issue description, blah, 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 working group observations, blah, blah, blah. Preliminary working recommendation. The working group does not recommend the elimination of FOAs. And just to summarize the two sections above that I kind of skimmed through, I think we found that while EPP auth info codes are important as a technical security mechanism, they did not provide sufficient paper trail of a registrant's awareness of and acceptance of a transfer, sorry, not registrant, transfer context, awareness of the transfer in case something went wrong. So in the vast majority of transfers, the EPP auth info code would be used, and that would be fine, but in those few cases where something were to go off the rails, the FOA was necessary to untangle that dispute and establish that authorization was, in fact, sought and obtained. So I don't know. Does anyone want to spend some more time on this? I think that we have, again, we have several months since we looked at this one last, and it was fairly non-controversial at the time, but I want to make sure that folks have an opportunity to raise their hand if they have objections or something's changed their mind in the interim. So, okay. I don't see any see anyone jumping up to put the brakes on this one either. So I think we're good then with F, and then that takes us to the end of our charter questions and our preliminary recommendations. So thanks, everyone. This has been a long time coming to get to this point, and I think we've hit a decent milestone here. So I'll just do that little applause for that. Okay. moving then to agenda item number 3, which is we want to take a look at the use cases for Annex C, which harkens back to our discussion of charter question C regarding the dispute options for registrants. And we wanted to go through these. And Mikey, would it be too much to put you on the spot here? Because I know you kind of held the pen on a lot of these use cases and making sure that there wasn't too much overlap and that they were all distinct. Would that be okay if you kind of walked us through those? Or?
Yeah, this is Mikey. That would be fine. Lars, do you have a copy of it? I thought I was headed for the bottom of the document, but I realize it's not in there. So if you've got one handy to upload, otherwise I can dredge up the draft really quick. I see your hands up. You want to take it away for a minute?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I'm sorry about that. I hadn't realized when I created the PDF from the Word document, it for some reason it did not include the annex. So I'm just doing a copy paste situation. It'll be 1 minute. I'm really sorry about this.
Oh, see, and I think the agenda said, if time permits, so you had no faith that we were going to get to this item in our agenda, right?
Yeah. Some people just...
Maybe, James. Maybe.
Well, you know, Lars, I could go into screen sharing mode, and it might be better anyway, because I realized that this is a draft that I meant to go back to, so it's in considerably rougher shape than it should be, and so let me just go into screen sharing mode, and then maybe we can do a little editing on the fly. Let me just set my screen up so that it'll work. Okay, so we'll get rid of that. We'll get this going. There are a few more. James, someday I'm going to have to show you how to do this. It's kind of fun. Okay, so here we go. You should be seeing, yeah, you see what I see? All right, so I'm in the draft Word document. There we go. So what this is a combination of the use cases that we came up with and the use cases that compliance described as what they can do. And so I put these together and didn't really remove any duplicates. I didn't do much terribly controversial, but the reason I really wanted to take you all through this is because I made a lot of guesses when it comes to those columns over on the other side. Actually, as I think about it, I'm going to impose on you all one more time because I think I want to do this in the spreadsheet. Because what I'd like to do is walk you through the guesses that I made and see if... oh my gracious. Oh, that's why it's so goofy. Sorry, everybody gets to see my my life as I go look for the I sure hope I can find this in a reasonable amount of time. Not all readable ones, just Excel files. Thank you very much. Ah, there it is, right there. I think that's the last version. Yeah, okay. Okay, let me make that a little bit bigger so you can read it. No, not quite that big. Let's see what happens if I shrink that just a touch. Because basically what's going on in this spreadsheet is that each little section has a drop-down menu that we can pick. And so what I want to do is take you through these sort of line by line. They're not that many, and I think once I get a sense from you all as to the answers, I can go ahead and carry forward. Oh, thanks, Lars, for widening that out. That was a big help. So these first ones, as I was saying, are largely compliance. And the controversial part that I want to highlight are these ones that are blue in the parties column. And I went and got a little bit adventuresome here, and I need especially the registrars to take a hard look at this and see what you think. Because just to walk you through this first one, this top row, so the first one is a registrar is not authorizing a transfer out or is not providing an auth info code in a timely way. Clearly, IRTP and TERP apply. Compliance thinks it has a role in this one. And the reason that I need you to think about this is I decided that sometimes registrants are a party, and in a way this is consistent with the conversation we had on the list today, which is it's often the registrant who's going to be sticking their hand up and saying, hey, wait, the registrar is not authorizing the transfer out. What should I do? So I'm not saying that they're authorized to launch a TDRP. We've had that discussion. But they are a party to all this, and they need to know what to do about this problem if they don't get satisfaction from their registrar. And I want to say that a lot over and over again and give you registrars a chance to sort of think about that and whether that's consistent with the way you'd like this table to look, because this is mostly documentation. It's not policy, but if this gives you heartburn, this is a good time to talk about it. So I've talked on for a while. I haven't seen any hands get flung up. Bladel's got his hand up. Go for it, James.
Hey, Mike, thanks. James Bladel speaking. As a registrar, I think that this is fairly reflective of the status quo because and certainly looking for some of the other registrars to jump in here, but we have seen notifications from, let's say, ICANN or from, where the source of the complaint was either another registrar attempting to execute a transfer on behalf of a registrant or from that registrant themselves. So I don't think that this is, I don't think we're blazing new trails here. I think that this is occurring. I think that's also true of the item number 3 about the registrar not unlocking the name. Now, that said, I think those are fed through, they kind of wind their way through the other registrar and ICANN. They don't, it's never a case where just one party is unilaterally raising these issues. They usually are done in conjunction with other parties. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, it does help, and it's consistent with the intent that I had for that category, which is not to say who drives the dispute or who has access to the TDRP, but just to acknowledge that there are cases when registrars and registrants are both parties to it. So would you say that three I left as entirely between registrars, but what I heard you say was that this was another one of these that's more like registrars and registrants. Is that right, James?
I think that's correct. I don't know if Volker wants to weigh in on that, but I think that is correct. We have, again, seen instances where a registrant is contacting us directly or a registrar is contacting us on behalf of their customers. So I think that's correct.
Okay. All right, so let me just step you quickly through the rest of these with the intent that if anybody in the working group is uncomfortable in either direction, either, you know, registrants are uncomfortable or registrars, we'll just stop. But otherwise, I'll just start walking you through this. So the next one that compliance brought up was that the registrar is not participating. And several attempts have been made by the other registrar, including hitting the emergency action contact. And in that case, it seemed to me that that's largely a registrar-to-registrar kind of problem, and that clearly compliance has a role in there, and that the registrar's next step would be to go to compliance if they can't get the... But I wouldn't expect a registrant to get terribly involved in this because I imagine they wouldn't see it. Next one is registrar is not unlocking a name. That's the one we just went through. Another version of that is the registrar is not allowing the registrant to unlock the name by themselves. Similar kind of thing. The next one is, again, sort of inside the process rather than out, you know, and so I put it between the registrars. Here the administrative contact and the registrant are in conflict. And here I'm saying ICANN policy does not apply. And that gets me to a new version, a new thing to talk about. When I'm filling this cell out this way, what I'm saying is ICANN policy does not apply today, but when IRTPC gets implemented, it may. So,
Mikey,
oh my goodness, look at all that! I've got to rearrange my screen so that I can see all these hands. Go ahead, James, and then.
Real quickly, 2 points. On item number 7, item number 7, administrative contract versus registrant, the ICANN policy actually does cover that scenario, and it states very clearly that the registrant authorization or denial of authorization will overrule the administrative contract authorization. So I think we're clear on that one. What I think we're trying to capture with this use case is that two registrants, it's number 9. So I wanted to draw a distinction between number 7 and number 9 because number 7 is very clearly and explicitly called out in, I believe, IRTP somewhere buried in there. I'll have to look it up. But it's like one sentence, but it says something in the event that the registrants and the administrative contract do not agree on the authorization for a transfer, the registrant's authorization shall prevail, something like that. So it's, so I think that's covered. I did want to step back one bit to item 6, because I think if we go up one... Oh, I'm sorry. Am I going too
far? Sorry. No. There. Spastic click. I'm sorry. I apologize. I apologize frantically. Sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. We're about 5 seconds delayed on the screen, so when you did that, it took me a minute to see what you were.
Yeah. Well, it was exciting. Whoa, what happened? Okay, back to six.
So back to six, whether the FOAs are not sent to the two transfer contacts. So obviously the FOA has to be sent by the gaining registrar in order to transfer the name. That's required. But I think it was IRTPB, perhaps C, get these all mixed up, where we did also require the losing registrar to send an FOA to the transfer contact. So how will we know if that second part... So I agree with you. Existing IRTP TDRP applies, but I don't know that it's entirely between registrars, because I think it's possible that a registrant could say, hey, I got the FOA from my new registrar, but I didn't get the FOA from my old registrar, and they're supposed to do that. I think that might be, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm looking for other folks to weigh in, but I think that might be correct.
That seems like the most straightforward approach. This is exactly what I wanted to do. And one of the things I want to also do is
did we lose you?
No, I'm typing. And, you know, chewing gum and walking at the same time, I have a really hard time with that.
That's okay. You just stopped in the middle of the sentence. I wondered if you lost you.
Yeah.
I got kicked
up. Priority interrupt. Sorry. So I may go ahead and make two out of this so that we can make that distinction clearer.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay. Oh, gracious, all these hands went down, so James caught all the mistakes I made. Way to go, James.
Sorry, folks. Didn't mean to steal your thunder.
Okay, so let's see. So we've done that one. We've done seven. Eight. When the opcode is sent to the wrong who is contact.
Volker's back in the queue.
Oh, Volker, go ahead. Thank you, James. Volker, you're silent. You're muted, I bet. You're still muted. Oh, where James is, even the screen is freezing. Volker is saying, Oh, is it the dreaded microphone problem again? Yeah, I bet it is. You want to give James a shorthand hint? Maybe he can carry the ball for you. James, if you can keep an eye on the chat, maybe Volker can.
I will. I'll watchdog that for you.
Yeah, that'd be great. Sorry to hear your mic's broken, Volker. Okay, let's see. Where are we? Authcode is sent to the wrong who is contact to the account holder that is sometimes not listed in the who is. This is one of theirs. I'm not sure. To the account holder that is sometimes not listed in who is.
Mike, is James, can I...
Yeah, jump in, please.
If this is a true use case, then someone, I don't know if it's compliance or the registrar liaison, but somebody needs to, we have a registrar that is totally lost and doesn't know how to execute transfers, and they need help more than sanctions, because they just clearly don't know what they're doing. So... I don't mean to sound silly here, but I feel like this is such a basic and elemental component that if someone is doing this, and I see Barbara's hands up, maybe she can help me understand if there's maybe a scenario that I'm not seeing, but it feels like if someone's doing this, that they're doing it wrong.
Barbara, go ahead.
Thank you, Mikey and James. This is Barbara for the transcript. So my only comment here was I don't know that the IRTP really indicates who the auth info code would be sent to. It just basically says the registrar has an obligation to provide it within 5 days of, you know, a request for that from, and it might say the registrant or registered name holder. So from that perspective, I don't know that it gets into that much detail as far as specifically who it has to be sent to. Is that right, or does anyone can anyone else confirm whether or not that's the case? Does the state?
I'm looking that up now. Sorry, this is
point of contact.
This is James. I'm looking that up now, and I thought that the FOA was required to be sent to the transfer contact, which would be to the registrant or the admin contact. But I'm going to confirm because now I'm wondering if they just kind of glossed over that part. So let me circle back and check.
Right. And so I guess my only comment here was if it's not specific, if it just says the registered name holder, I don't know if that necessarily equates to the transfer point of contact being either the registrant or the administrative contact.
So, James, can I give you an action to chase this one down?
I've got it here. For the gaining registrar, the authorization must be made via valid standard form of authorization, FOA. There are two different FOAs available on the ICANN website. The FOA labeled initial authorization for registrar must be used by the gaining registrar to request authorization for a registrar transfer from the transfer contact. And it says, FOA labeled confirmation of registrar transfer request must be used to the registrar of record to request confirmation from the transfer contact. And then earlier on, I believe it defines transfer contact as the registrant, registered name holder, or admin contact.
Ooh. Yeah, this is the long who trumps discussion that we had way back when.
May I jump in on that? Because
yeah, go ahead, Volker. Point. Well, welcome back to the microphone.
Yeah, that stupid mistake. I forgot to turn on audio on the Adobe. So
there you go.
That's what caused it. No, that's the question I always had when I read that policy because the way I've always read it is that I'm speaking of Section 1.1 of the policy on transfer of registration between registrars is that while the registered name holder's authority supersedes that of the administrative contact, I think that's only for the time where the transfer is still pending. Once it's done, it's transferred with authority because the administrative name holder has the administrative contact has that authority. So it's just a short window where the registered name holder has the ability to supersede, at least in the way I've always interpreted the policy. But I might be wrong on that. I think it's a hole in the policy in that we might want to look at and try to fix or clarify. That's exactly the puzzler I've been looking at for a couple of times as well. When does the in what time span does the superseding of the transfer request happen? Because if it's perpetually, any transfer that occurs with the authority of the administrative contact only, that means that for some registrars, all transfers in could be revoked at some point if the registered name holder thinks, oh, the deal I made back then wasn't such a good deal, I just override the administrative contact's authority on that.
I think this looks like a little job for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll stick that in there like that, just as a note. I don't think we can solve it today on this call. We can tease these out. But, you know, this is one of the beauties of these use cases is that this is our chance to really, and I think that this fits in to this notion that we've had for quite a while, that this is likely to be the last IRTP for a while, and we may want to just tidy some things up. And this falls nicely in that category, it seems to me. Let's see. Barbara, you're back in the queue, and then James. Barbara?
Thank you, Mikey. This is Barbara. So our interpretation, when we get a dispute, and quite a few of the disputes that we've received under the TDRP have related to the registrant basically challenging the transfer on grounds that they did not authorize it. So we in our interpretation here at VeriSign Registry is that if a transfer dispute has been filed on the grounds that the admin contact authorized the transfer without basically the authority or agreement of the registrant, then, you know, we would view it as the, you know, in challenges of those type that the language within the IRTP relating to the registrant trumping the admin contact to apply. So I don't know if that helps, Volker, but we view it as, you know, from, you know, a dispute perspective, that if the registrant wasn't aware of it or didn't authorize it, then, you know, we would allow them to basically trump it.
So it seems like what we've identified is sort of two opposite interpretations, one being that there's a narrow window when the registrant can trump, and another interpretation, which is that window is quite a bit longer. And so I think our action item still holds. We need to clarify that. Mm. I'm not sure we can solve it on the fly today, but I've certainly captured that as one that we want to talk about. Volker, you want to go next?
That's the old vestigial hand.
Old hand, vestigial hand. Okay, James, take it away.
Sorry. So this issue really dusting off, going back now to IRTPA, which was chaired by Paul Diaz, who has since left the registrar and now with the registry, and sent his apologies for today's call. But I think that his spidey senses would definitely be tingling for this conversation, because this was one of the charter questions for IRTPA, and so I would think that we could go back and take a look at the recommendations for that working group and see what we came up with, because this issue was examined. And I just wanted to point out that our interpretation of this is much closer to Barbara's characterization rather than Volker's description, because language of the policy is very front and center at the first, I think it's the first or second paragraph, saying that only the registrant and the admin contact have the authority to authorize a transfer, and in the event of a dispute or disagreement between the two, the registered name holder, overrides the admin contact. So I think we've taken a more, liberal interpretation of that, in terms of that doesn't mean that there's a very tight window for them to raise an objection, but they could even come back later and say, I did not authorize this transfer, please undo it, and we would work with them to get that done. So I think it's closer to Barbara's description of that relationship. But I would recommend, if we can set a homework assignment for staff, to go back and take a look at the recommendations for a charter question, IRTPA, the charter question about the registered name holder versus admin authorization.
Cool. All right. Holly, you're next.
It's just a question, maybe a conceptual question. We're talking about the admin contact as if they are not the registrant, whereas my understanding would be an admin contact is something within the registrant. So it's just it's a use of language, but I think it's a little bit confusing. So when we talk about, well, the registrant overrides the admin contact, what we're saying is the registrant actually is a larger entity, and there's an admin contact within the registrant, but there is a higher authority. And, you know, that just seems to me something that we need to clarify, because it doesn't logically work this way. If you see what I mean? I mean, maybe everybody's lived with this language for so long, but I'm struggling to say, well, the registrant is separate from and apart from the admin contact. Is that correct?
This is Mikey. I'll dive in and then hand it over to Volker. But yes, it is correct. The registrant could be ABC Widget Company,
right.
Main Street, et cetera, et cetera. The admin contact could be a person.
Yep.
And it could be a person who works for ABC Widget, but it doesn't have to be.
Okay.
And so the registrant is the trumps, because they're the, you know, you can't use the word owner because it's complicated, but, you know, they're the person that has the license to use the name. And the admin contact could or could not be a subset of that. Volker, I don't know if you're talking about that. If you are, feel free to chime in. Otherwise, I'll just tie this off with Holly, before I get to your question.
No, Mikey, you're exactly right. That's the way that we see it used commonly by our customers as well. There's customers that actually do nominate someone within their own company to be the administrative contact. In many cases, it's the registrant himself who just puts himself down for the second role as well. And in other cases, it's the reseller, it's the website provider. It can be anyone who is administering the domain name for the registrant. So it doesn't need to be someone within the organization, but it can very well be.
But final question: the registrant will have named this person, so there is necessarily some kind of relationship between the two.
Again, this is Mikey.
Actually,
yes and no.
Thank you.
That's the reason that we went through the discussion, is because of there are use cases, and we're getting a little bit off track, but there are some use cases where the registrant isn't even aware that they are the registrant, you know, especially in the case of a third party putting up a website for them or something like that.
Yeah.
So, Volker, new point? Old hand. Okay. It's starting to get toward the top of the hour. We're certainly not going to get through all of these. I guess we've got another 10 minutes. So let me just wrap up number 8. I'm not changing anything in number 8 because this particular use case isn't about what we've been talking about. This use case is about where the registrar sends it to the auth code to the wrong place. And James's point is if they have that problem, they need education. And so I'm leaving this as entirely between registrars. We are going to suck out an action item to clarify that language, but as James refreshes my fading memory, I think we do have pretty good language in the policy that's pretty clear, but James and Volker especially have a slightly different interpretation of that, and so we should nail that down and make sure that the policy is clear enough. So I'll leave the action. But I'm not expecting that to be too hard. The next one is the beginning of my list, extracted from our conversations on a couple of calls back. And so the first one is, two registrants are disputing the right to a domain name after an inter-registrar transfer, misspelled, sorry. Registrars went through the right process and have no information to add. And this is the classic example of one that current ICANN policy does not apply, but an inter-registrant dispute mechanism process could be made available as a result of IRTPC getting implemented. And so compliance doesn't think they have a role right now, and this is entirely between registrants, so registrars don't have a role either. So this is the beginning of a long list of examples of inter-registrant transfers. And we will leave that for IRTPC implementation and various implementation review teams to work out. And here, well, I guess what I'm saying on this one is this is a straight registrant-to-registrant dispute. And so I'm saying ICANN policy doesn't apply at all. The next one, number 10, I'm saying that the inter-registrant policy might apply. And so you can see why I feel like we need to look at this kind of hard. Christine, go ahead.
Hey, just to be clear, this is Christine from National Arbitration Forum. Just to be clear, Mikey, are you saying that the hijacking situation that I was emailing about in our thread, the example I emailed around, fits under 9 or fits under 10?
I think that what this is showing is what happens when you write these up on the fly on a call. I have to look at these. I think that the number 10 one, if I can recreate the dialogue, is from the registrar's perspective, where the registrars are saying, you know, both of these registrants were in Whois at some point or another. We can't figure out who they are. And thus, maybe the IRTPC stuff will apply. Now, let's go apply the hijacking.
Right. I think that I read it that way. Oh, sorry, Mike.
Yeah, no worries. The hijacking one, I would think hijacking does not apply to 9. Because what 9 is saying is registrars went through the right process and thus have no information to add. In the case of a hijacking, something was wrong in the process.
Well, not necessarily, because, I mean, maybe it's just a semantic thing, but that the string that I sent around, the registrars that have replied to my example have all said, the registrars did everything right.
Yes.
The fact that the registrant allowed his email to be hacked is his own problem. So that's why I'm just wondering. I think it fits under 9 because if I mean, and I am not going to argue with our esteemed registrars on this call who know far more about this than I do. I mean, I'm not going to disagree and say that the registrars did anything wrong. Something somewhere went wrong, and that is the exact type of dispute that we keep getting questions about, that I'm thinking we could recommend that I can develop a way to solve the problem. So that's why I guess I was not really trying to ask a leading question when I asked you whether it went under 9 or 10. I think it goes under 9, but I was kind of also interested to hear other people's opinions about that.
I'm going to blur your eyes for just a minute because, you know, we've got some other use cases.
Ah.
And I think what we need to do is see if we've – I think if we don't have a hijacking one, we need one. That's basically where I'm going. Now, the problem with hijacking, of course, is who determines whether it's a hijacking. I guess that really those are the two. It's between 9 and 10. My preference, I see Kevin and James in the queue. Let me just cogitate for one more minute. I think my preference is I would like to have hijacking addressed by the inner registrant transfer that's coming out of IRTPC. That's the reason that we put it there. So that would be my initial leaning. Now on to Kevin and then to James. Kevin, go ahead. Kevin, you may be muted. It's pretty quiet at this end.
Hi, this is Kevin. I just wanted to follow up on Christine's comment and the comment about the registrars, you know, if as long as all the, you know, they got the right code and, you know, the registrant got hacked, that's the registrant's problem. But I will point out that part of what the registrar does is, you know, maintains the DNS listings, which can also be used to hack in to the email account of the registrant. And while I don't think it's extremely common, it is possible, and I believe it has happened once or twice, that the registrar has been hacked, and that is how the email gets hacked of the registrant, which starts the cascade of fund transfers. And so while the registrar may be saying, well, gee, I complied with all the, you know, quote, policy because I got the right code, I did what I was supposed to do, and my hands are clean, but the right code may have been fraudulently obtained because of hacking into the registrar's system, which is something the registrar can't pull. Now, I would imagine that would be the less frequent cause, and the more frequent cause would be something that the registrant did that allowed the code to be used improperly. But I think that it's notable to say that we just don't know in those cases, you know, who the party, quote, at fault is, and in fact it might be a combination of the two. I think it's a pretty complex question. I'm not sure how exactly that would fit in to all of the ICANN policies, but I think it's a scenario that merits noting as at least possible, and one that we should, you know, consider how it fits into the matrix, because it's really, you know, on one sense, objectively a single case, but then when you get into the details, it could be a couple different scenarios involved. So that's my long-winded response to Christine's comments and some of the earlier comments on the thread.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. I'll let James go next, but then I've got an idea. Go ahead, James.
Thanks, Mikey, and just noting that we're getting towards the end of our time slot here. So, as responding to Kevin and backing up some of what Christine is saying, I think that when we talk about hijackings, I don't know that that is a use case, okay? It's kind of like, what are the different types of transactions that you can do at the bank? And you're putting together your bank procedures. Well, someone could want to deposit, someone could want to cash a check, someone could want to withdraw. And then you're saying, well, someone could come up with a ski mask and a gun, you know, and then trying to design the policy around that. It's a special case where someone has been, you know, could be the registrant's email or the registrant's, password to their registrar account or the registrar systems themselves, or, you know, hasn't happened yet, but certainly in the future it could be theoretically that the registry systems were compromised. So I think trying to include a box for bad actors have broken into and destroyed or stolen, I think is taking us down a particular rabbit hole that's starting to make everybody's head hurt a little bit. So I think what we might want to do, as Mikey has indicated, is step outside of that a little bit, look at the implementation, look about how we would be able to undo any transfers if they were found to be the result of fraud, theft, hacking, security breach, whatever, and then just give the service providers the broad authority to undo those things. But have to remember that any sort of emergency powers can also be abused, and so we would have to also make sure that that service providers were also cleared from liability. I mean, one of the reasons why a registrar doesn't go in and just start undoing hijacking is because, you know, the hijacker could be the person claiming the hijacking. So you're just not 100% sure, and you're not willing to bet your company on that you've got the right person. So, I'm kind of just throwing this out here as something fodder for our discussions. I apologize for missing that thread on the email. It sounded like a good one. But I think that we might want to draw a box around this and move on a little bit here, Mikey, because the things that Christine are talking about and the things that Kevin raised are very real, very, very impactful situations. But they are all happening outside of the policy framework and are being done by bad people manipulating these mechanisms to their own benefit and victimizing not just the registrants, but in some cases service providers as well.
Thanks, James. We are right at the top of the hour, so let me sort of wrap this up. I see your hand up, Christine, but see what you think of this idea. I think clearly this is a conversation that's not done. And so what I would suggest we do as a way to move forward on this is let's carry on that conversation that we started on the list this week about the hijacking cases and write us a few use cases. Pretty narrowly, the narrower the better, so that we can say, okay, that kind fits in these buckets and this kind doesn't and so on. I think the more granular we can come up with the scenarios, the easier it will be to have these conversations. And I think one of the difficulties we're having right now is the broadness of the conversation. And I sort of ran down the list, and I don't feel comfortable that we've got a really robust set of hijacking use cases yet. And so that would be my suggestion as sort of the next thing for us to do. We can pick this up again next week. I think the other thing that we probably should think about is what happens to the report between now and next week. And I think that we are getting close enough that we probably want to broaden our scope of review of the language of the report to include the very substantial section that's immediately prior to the actual recommendation section. And if I can get to the right document, I did. What I'm thinking about is, we've spent a fair amount on Section 7. Oh, no, I guess it's 5. No, it's the second half of 5. Anyway, what I'm saying is that we need to start looking as a group at 3, 4, and 5 with a fairly careful editorial review. Partly to make sure that it reads well and partly to make sure that it's consistent with what we're recommending. And then I think at the same time carry on with this use case discussion about hijacking. Because I don't feel like we've really got that one quite granular enough yet. Does that feel about right, James? Old fellow co-chair as an approach?
Yeah, Mikey. Thanks. That sounds good.
All right. Over to you. I'm done.
Okay, well, it is the top of the hour, and it sounds like we're going to have a hard stop today. But thanks, everyone, for joining the call and for this participation. Let's continue, as Mikey has suggested, particularly interested in discussing more of these hijackings. I'm not ready to call them a use case. I feel like they kind of occur outside of the whole ecosystem, but we can talk about that on the list. And we will be scheduled for next week. Getting close to the time where we want to start going through these things a little more granularly and getting ready to publish our report in advance of Singapore. So with that, thanks, everyone, and I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks, James.